They were all convicted. So you got a decapitation, two-pronged, the roundup and summary deportation of the so-called foreign anarchist leadership, and the obliteration of the actual anarcho-syndicalist organization that happened in about a two-year period of time. Now, you got to stop for a second and ask yourself, what were the contours of the American labor movement? What were the consciousness of the American working class be in 2001 if in 1921 they hadn't totally destroyed a very viable, vibrant, and growing anarchist labor movement on a basis of what amounts to counterintelligence intervention? Okay, you got the repressive statutes, but you've also got the people who weren't roped into these mass trials. And the Chicago trial was simply the largest. It wasn't the only one. You had one in Sacramento of 40 people. You had one in Kansas of 36 people, and so on. The elimination of the leadership structure in toto. But key organizers in the field were simply being assassinated. Frank Little, for example, was made an example of by Pinkerton agents working in collaboration with a local Bureau of Investigation office in Montana, and was essentially lynched. No, there's nothing essentially about it. He was lynched, period, and left hanging on a railroad trestle as a warning to other radical organizers to get the hell out of the mining fields of Montana. And this was a throwback to the Reno operation that I didn't talk about in the 19th century. And finally, you got one other that I want to make from early 20th century as an example, a guy by the name of Marcus Garvey. Garvey, head of United Negro Improvement Association, which to this day remains the largest mass movement, mass organization of African Americans in the history of the United States, who had a certain set of politics early in his life, but by the time he gets UNIA on the board, really would have been probably someone that the more conscious Republicans over in the Bush White House would have coveted as a leader for the black community now, because it was black self-sufficiency. Kind of a precursor to Farrakhan's rap. Business starts. Community organizing, self-help, stuff like that. Blacks weren't supposed to self-help in those days. They were supposed to be utterly dependent, as in large part they remain today. But he was targeted on that basis. You got to be dependent. You got to be a surplus labor force to keep the cost of labor down among white workers who were the preferred workers. We need to take you out. How did they take him out? On a stock fraud thing. He was trying to start something called a Black Star Steamship Line. Put out an advertisement for investors. People invested Black Star at the particular moment. If I remember the specifics of the case correctly, Black Star at that moment did not need a infusion of capital, but they had other businesses in the constellation of things that UNIA was trying to get going that did need capital. No one ever accused Garvey of profiting from it. He simply put the investment for Black Star Line into another business and went to prison, maximum security in Atlanta, on a 10-year sentence. Ultimately was deported. They let him out of prison on a quid pro quo. He'd never come back to the United States. UNIA collapses. But now there's something very interesting in this. You got an active investigation of Marcus Garvey that's undertaken in 1918. The conviction does not occur until 1924. The guy in charge of the investigation in 1918 is this file clerk by the name of John Edgar Hoover. And he writes this little letter at the end of his intensive field investigation of Marcus Garvey. He said, "We have done the investigation. We have scrutinized Garvey's activities extraordinarily closely, and, quote, unfortunately, end quote, we can find no violations of federal law. And therefore, I recommend the investigation continue. If we look at him long enough, we will find something. I'm confident." And ultimately, they do on this pretext. And this is a technical violation of law as well. Stock fraud, manipulation of the stock market. Can we think of another contemporaneous example of somebody manipulating the stock market? How about President of the United States, this revered figure in American history, John F. Kennedy, his daddy, Joe, who took money off bootlegging with Dutch Schultz and gambling operations with Arnold Rothstein, funneled him into the stock market, had himself positioned so he could manipulate things in such a way that he had actual tangible impact in the stock market collapse of 1929. His punishment was to be drawn into the Treasury Department to write a set of laws to prevent anyone from doing what it was he'd just done. They let him keep the money, incidentally, which is how the Kennedys got rich. And he did that so well, outlawing his own activities, that they made him the first Irish ambassador to the court of St. James, just a little different than the experience of Marcus Garvey on the cheap, don't you think? I mean, there's about $10,000 involved in the Garvey case, none of it pocketed. There's about $30 million in personal profit involved in the Kennedy case, and you can see the difference in outcomes. So I do not need to hear arguments of a technical nature as to, well, you did break the law. Coming from an entity which violates its own constitutional requirement for equal justice before the law and is at odds with every single element of international law which is supposedly binding on its comportment, I don't need to hear about buckle your seatbelt. It's the law. Now, what would the face of the African-American community at the dawn of a new century look like if UNIA had not been neutralized as a matter of political expedience under the pretext of law by counterintelligence specialists of the Bureau of Investigation as a very, very high national priority? Labor movement, anarchist movement, black movement, these are major counters. An eliminating possibility every time this happens. People conceive a viable alternative to their assigned place in the order of things, and they set about creating that reality, and they're moving on it, and it's a very constructive and hopeful site, and then it's shattered, and penalties are visited. There's a message. There's a message there to the people who are involved in those things, and there's a message to their children. They're sending a message. They're sending a message. That's a term that they put out in the 1980s quite a lot. We're doing particular things we're doing not because they're necessary to do in their own right. We're overreacting, perhaps. But what we're trying to do is send a message to others by making examples. They're making examples of constructive things in order to maintain an extraordinarily repressive, regressive social order. The order that we all oppose. Well, the 1956 inset of COINTELPRO, it's a maintenance instrument, basically. We can talk about a whole proliferation of comparable antecedent arguments. But 56 is an interesting date when they start this up. It's on the tail end of the period that's somewhat erroneously known as McCarthyism. And basically what you've got at that point is an absolute obliteration of everything to the left of Attila the Hun and the entire social fabric of the United States. Okay? It would have made Frank Rizzo up in Philadelphia really, really proud. But the entire discourse, and 30 years later, you still see the ramifications of what they did to the conceptual understandings, the possibility of conceiving alternatives in the United States. And what it is that happens 30, actually 20 years later, is they start a little program on CNN. Some of you may have seen it. It's called Crossfire. That's where the left and the right engage one another. Yeah, it's a joke now, but you should have seen it in the beginning. They had on the right Bob Novak. Okay, this is truth in advertising. This is truly way right. I mean, Heinrich Himmler would be embarrassed with some of this stuff. Yeah, the right is ably represented here, and on the left you have Tom Brady, whose main pedigree is having been CIA station chief in Italy in the immediate post-World War II environment to subvert the Italian elections to prevent the Italian communists from gaining seats by the electoral process. That's the left. And so you got something that would be fascistically right-wing as the left, and then you've got something way, way to the right of that. And that's the political discourse in the United States. And you wonder how people get so screwed up in their perceptions of things, and they're actually peddling this as being a left-right debate. This didn't happen by accident. In the context of the U.S. political discourse at the time, that actually is a left-right juxtaposition. This country is so far to the right that it really would make the Third Reich kind of shudder. They hadn't conceived these politics. This has not got to do with the racial content. It's got to do with the politics themselves. You have Nazis further to the left than the average American political pundit, and that's a fact. Go check it out. Check the Strasser brothers and so forth. I'm not trying to redeem these guys. I'm just trying to point it out for purposes of comparison. And this did not happen because there's something congenital in the American body politic which drives people into right-wing postures from birth. It takes some engineering. We're talking about the process of engineering. This is the goal of this stuff. So what did they do with COINTELPRO? They set up a process by which they could maintain that repression of political consciousness on a permanent level without having to do public dog and pony shows like the show trials of the 1940s and 50s. And they used as a laboratory, if you will, something called the Communist Party to do it. Now, the Communist Party had been the main target of the McCarthyites, and they were doing it right out front in public and purging anyone from any position of influence in American life because not of membership or participation in the Communist Party, but any kind of association at all, even three and four steps removed. It was that deep a cut in the political involvement of Americans, the realm of permissibility that had been made. But you can't maintain that public profile forever, so they decided to maintain it that way in secret. They used the CP, which was moribund. It no longer really existed. It had been destroyed. They revived it. That was the bit about the jokes. They began to infiltrate FBI personnel in phenomenal numbers into the Communist Party, taking with them cash resources to create the appearance that there was an entity so that they could practice techniques of destroying and maintaining and subverting it. Infiltrate, take over the leadership, mislead it, badjack it. The bona fide cadres, you understand about badjacking. This is one of the most insidious techniques there is. Comes out of prisons. But they apply it in a broader social circumstance here. That's where they will infiltrate people, establish their credibility, and they use the credibility they've established as infiltrators, agent provocateurs, to discredit the legitimate activists within the organization is targeted, usually by making a case that they are the infiltrators and the cops. So you end up with all these scenarios where people are sitting there cop-baiting one another to the point of paranoia and self-neutralization, and that's actually something they come out with in the late 1960s with the SDS, with the Students for a Democratic Society. It said the purpose of the operation was to convince the genuine activists that there was an agent behind every mailbox and in their bedroom with them. Two different memos juxtaposed create this paranoid condition which would be in itself sufficient in many cases to prevent people from engaging in actual constructive political activity. They would be so absolutely unable to make a determination of who they could trust to work with. So it goes by cop baiting, it goes by rumor mongering, it goes by internal dissemination of disinformation. Really? Move from the Communist Party, COINTELPRO, the incept date of which is 1956, to 1960, they take on the SWP as well. Now that's a little Trotskyite organization, doing pretty much the same thing that they had done with the Communist Party. Communist Party ends up being 50% agent personnel, the SWP ends up being 30% agent personnel, and then they take on the Puerto Rican independence movement. They never really declared an INSEP date for that, but that's in 1960 as well. And you start to have these overlaps with the civil rights movement that's emerging in the South, SCLC, NAACP, and so forth, Robert Williams, and in particular because initially the SWP is trying to collaborate, provide support to Williams' wing of the NAACP. They said it's all a communist plot. Wouldn't have been too difficult for J. Edgar Hoover to arrive at this particular position. He's been FBI director since 1924. Okay, he's a rabid anti-communist and he's a rabid racist. Refers to Martin Luther King as being Burrhead. The Burrhead is the FBI code name for Martin Luther King. So the racial content and the sensibilities of the people who are doing this sort of thing really tend to speak for themselves. There was never a formal COINTELPRO declared against SCLC although they engage in all of the activities of counterintelligence that they're developing with the CP and the SWP, okay, there is no COINTELPRO under that nomenclature declared against the offshoots and the people who disagree, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Corps and so forth. You've got disagreements. There's not a homogeneous block of organizations out there who are composed of different age groups or religious sensibilities that comprise the civil rights movement. They take them all under fire in various ways, okay? But they never declare under that cryptonym, which simply means counterintelligence program directed at domestic targets. They never really open case files on them under that particular rubric, but you find all the operational techniques in the files of what it is that they do. What they, on the other hand, declare is a COINTELPRO against what they call white racist hate, white racist hate groups. There is a counterintelligence operation aimed at them. But you got to make a juxtaposition in order to understand how they work there. They will infiltrate. They will do the same things that they will do to us, to right-wingers or racists, in a whole lot of ways. But the intent was different. The outcome, what they intended to accomplish by it. What they were after with the CP was a laboratory experiment. What they were after was the SWP was to destroy the organization. What they're after, even though they're not declaring it a counterintelligence program per se, with regard to the various elements of the civil rights movement, is to destroy the organization. What they're after when they declare an open COINTELPRO in their internal documents with the Klan is to take over the Klan and use it as an instrumentality in the furtherance of their counterintelligence objectives, the other organizations. Now, here's how this works. The Klan, actually, in some of its dimensions in the South, there's always been a relationship with the government. In fact, the Klan has been the government in a number of instances in American history. It ran Indiana in the 1920s, for example. It ran Colorado in the 1920s. It ran New Jersey. This is not a Southern phenomenon specifically, although it has strength in the South. It's actually had more political success in the North than it has in the South. But in any event, you've got this clear interlock between Klan interests and government interests that runs like a current through 20th century American history. But you actually got some wild card players out there, particularly in Mississippi, with something called the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And they're not really coordinating what they're doing with the federal government. And it becomes ultimately embarrassing. They killed 3 civil rights workers that everybody knows about. They killed 30 civil rights workers. That means 27 of them are people you've never heard of. 3 of them got famous. Why? Because 2 of them are well-connected Jewish boys from New York City, major Democratic funders, which meant that their families were connected to the coordinator of Democratic politics for the state of New York. And when Mickey Schwerner disappeared, the guy got on the phone to Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was a president of the United States, said, "This is absolutely unacceptable. What are you going to do about it?" And what he did about it was give J. Edgar Hoover an ultimatum to resolve a murder case for the first time with regard to the repression of civil rights workers by the Klan, or he was going to send the Navy in to do it, which would have been embarrassing to Hoover. And so Hoover actually assigned a bunch of agent personnel. Top dog, top counterintelligence program personnel. William Sullivan ran the operation himself. That's the associate director of the FBI in charge of this sort of thing. And they went in about 3 weeks, fixed that problem. They didn't fix it the way you saw in Mississippi burning, through superior investigative work and all of that. They went in, they hired a Klansman, said, A, we will not prosecute you for complicity in the murder, and B, we'll pay you $30,000. All you got to do is first tell us where the bodies are, and then give us the evidence as to who did it so that we can have a successful conclusion to the case. So is your tax dollars at work? That's how long it took them, however. At any moment in that whole process of violence in the civil rights movement, the FBI could have rolled up the Klan like, I don't know, somebody's used toilet paper, I suppose. They had the option, and they proved it right there. But it goes beyond that. In his memoir, Sullivan says, by the fall of 64, this is 3 months after the Myburn killings occurred, we had control of the Mississippi Klan. The White Knights were under our control. We had 20% or more of their membership, including the top leadership positions. We ran the thing from there on. Okay? Now, you can almost see him beating his chest and how well he'd done, how effective his methods were. But 50 pages on in the book, he makes mention of between 1964 and 1969, there's 300 odd bombings by the Mississippi Klan in Mississippi. Now, if the FBI is 20% or more of the membership and they have all the top slots, who is it that did those 300 bombings, and who was it that got bombed? And why didn't you hear about it? Because it wasn't a wild card operation. It was a federal operation. It was an FBI operation. The guy who ran the operation said so, if you actually read what it was that he said. Take those two pieces and put them together. Okay, they were hitting the right targets. And what were the right targets? The targets were things that were fundamental to the civil rights movement, to the furtherance of black interests in the South. They were using the Klan. Their counterintelligence operation had been to take over the Klan, to use it as an instrumentality to repress the civil rights movement. We need to understand that as well. Black Panther Party, they do declare COINTELPRO. Black Panther Party is a very, how shall we put it, very committed, very dedicated, very undeterrable organization. It picks up on a lot of the Garveyan ideas. What is the Black Panther Party about? The Black Panther Party is about essentially black communities seceding from the order of things and establishing a self-sufficiency base of their own, so they can be in control of their own destiny. And that's why they're targeted. J. Edgar Hoover actually writes a memorandum in 1968 saying the most dangerous organization in the country, he's already said this at a press club conference, the most dangerous organization, the greatest threat to internal security of the United States is the Black Panther Party, which then numbers 500 people. Okay? Why? Well, he makes that clear in a subsequent memo. Because they're doing things like running a Breakfast for Children program, and he actually targets the feeding of school children before they go to school in the morning so that they'll have nutrient content, protein, and so forth, so they can do little things like think when they're in class, okay, as being a subversive activity, and makes it a number one priority target for elimination. Why? Because it self-sufficiency. Self-determination comes from self-sufficiency, and that disrupts the smooth ordering of things. Yeah, the Panther idea was an idea that would resonate with those 500 people who were resonating with, by poll at the time, 100,000 people in the black community. And that's what it was that was dangerous. It wasn't that they were killing cops. That was the packaging. And that's another end of the counterintelligence operation, is the packaging. There's a continuum of operational techniques, and it begins with disinformation, and that has to do with the packaging. And anybody that reads anything about the Black Panther Party at the time, contemporaneous stuff, or most of the post hoc historical assessments will find the word violence associated with them. The violence-prone Black Panthers, who are getting shot to pieces for serving eggs to kids in the morning, for running community health clinics, for trying to do job placement services, for rehabilitating slum buildings, for trying to make slum lords accountable to the people who are enriching them, and so on and so on and so on, trying to really constructively transform the fabric of the community existence, are targeted as being violent or violence-prone. And why? Because they exercised their constitutional right to defend themselves by arms if they were attacked by arms by the people who were in fact attacking them by arms. Between 1967 and 1971, 28 members of the Black Panther Party were killed by police and affiliated agencies. There's not one dead cop that you can hang your hat on. The one conviction was Huey Newton, which was a manslaughter conviction, and that was overturned in court. There is not one dead cop, 28 dead Panthers, that I have never seen a description of the violence-prone police agencies that were repressing the Black Panther Party under coordination of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You got to understand that the demonization, the packaging of organizations so that they will be repellent rather than attractive to the general sensibility of the American public is the first level of counterintelligence neutralization. The FBI has an entire stable, still to this day. They don't call it that anymore. You don't hear about it because it became embarrassing to hear about that. Information leaked out. They have what they call friendly or cooperating journalists. That means they'll write whatever the FBI tells them to write. In a lot of cases, they don't even write it. They have what they call a crime statistics division in the basement of the building. Those guys aren't dealing with crime statistics in any way at all. They're writing copy. And what you got is journalists out there with the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Washington Times and all the rest of these, LA Tribune and so forth, who habitually sign off copy that was written in the basement of the FBI building and put it out to you as news. Small wonder you're getting one point of view as a consensus viewpoint in the American media. That's good business, and they don't get attacked as a result. And they don't even have to work for a living. They just can go down to Joe Cocker's bar, okay, and watch C-SPAN, I suppose, ESPN, whatever it is they do, and get paid for it, and you get their copy, their byline, they get the awards. That's the first level. Second level is this infiltration, provocateur stuff, so that you're spreading disinformation person to person within the organization themselves in order to disrupt. If they can badjack at you, if they can get you discredited among your peers and neutralize your political effectiveness, if you are assessed by them as having some potential, they'll try to take you out that way. If they can't discredit you individually or organizationally in the media, they'll try to do it that way or some combination of the two. If that doesn't work, well, we got other techniques. Some of the techniques would include the creation of pseudo-gangs. That's the technique they picked up from a couple of British counterinsurgency, not counterintelligence, but counterinsurgency specialists by the name of Robin Everly and Frank Kitson. Okay? A pseudo gang, that's an interesting use. I said they always call us gangs. It's basically to create a political organization out of whole cloth in order to foment an ideological dispute where none otherwise existed. And you got some classic examples of that. You got the most classic of all probably being Lyndon LaRouche having the National Council of Labor Caucuses back at the inception of the 70s announced itself as being the hegemonic force of the left and proceeded to go around and trash everybody else's meetings by throwing bricks at their heads. Turns out they've been a government operation the whole time. LaRouche at that time was a paid federal employee. Okay, so you get an inside organization, you get an outside organization, you also have actual ideological disputes between bona fide organizations, exacerbate these using infiltrators, using disinformation. I got a classic case in Southern California between the United Slaves and the Black Panther Party where the FBI sat down with a cartoon kit and released cartoons in behalf of both organizations defaming the leadership of the other. So they copied, for the Black Panther Party, they copied the style of Emory Douglas, who was the house artist of the Black Panther Party. He was a minister of culture, did the cartoons. So you can find the back page of the Black Panther newspaper. They had an FBI artist sitting there copying his style, putting out things calling Juan Coringa, the head of the United Slaves, a pork chop nigger, insulting and degrading, knowing full well this is a very volatile situation. And in the assessment of the FBI, as they put it, extremely violence-prone organizations. They wanted to foment the animosity between the two groups and then, quote, let nature take its course. Nature took its course, ultimately, with a little more help from the FBI, with two infiltrators walking in to Campbell Hall on the UCLA campus on January 17th, 1969, and putting 357 caliber Magnum bullets in the heads of John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, who were the two primary leaders of the L.A. chapter of the Black Panther Party at the time. Okay, the shooter is a guy who's never been apprehended, and he was support cast with a couple guys by the name of Steiner, all on the FBI payroll. The Steiners were actually apprehended and convicted and walked out of a maximum security prison as escapees in California 3 years after the fact. Okay? They took credit for that in the internal memoranda as a successful operation. Huggins and Carter are dead. No FBI guy or no one attributable to the FBI actually pulled the trigger. But they created the circumstance, or so they said, and that's a believable thing, so it works so well, we recommend we continue the operation. 2 months later, Sylvester Bell gets killed in San Diego. Same thing. The intelligence, counterintelligence operative in the LA office who orchestrated the cartoon campaign said, look, it worked again. There's all kinds of disease, potential violence in the black community all throughout Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego, everywhere. And while we cannot take sole credit for this, it is attributable in large part to our counterintelligence initiatives. We recommend it be continued. Ultimately, in New Jersey, they're putting out a scorecard to try to antagonize membership of United Slaves there and get them into, quote, a shooting war with the Black Panther Party in the Northeast. It says, Panthers, zip us six.